Okay, good evening, everyone. Parsha Shmini, Tapshin Ayintes. Okay, we will start on page 590, bottom of the page, which is Perik Tes, Pasuk. We're going to start on page 592, which is Perik Yud, Pasuk Aleph. Vayikhu v'nei Aaron, Nadav Aviyu. Nadav and Aviyu, the sons of Aaron, took ish machtasai, each person his fire pan. Vayiknu v'hen eish, they put fire on it. Vayisimur le'akteris, they put incense on it. Vayakrivu v'nei Hashem eish zara. And they offered before Hashem a strange fire, asher lo yitziva oisam, that he had not commanded them. Vatetzei eish me'lefnei Hashem v'teichal oisam. A fire came out from before God and consumed them. Vayamusin upnei Hashem, and they died before God. So there is much commentary, much discussion about what exactly was the sin here of Nadav and Aviyu. Where did they go wrong? The Yalkut Shemayni says that this Yalkut Shemayni would seemingly not be a sin in itself, but rather a cause for whatever the sin was, whatever they did wrong, a cause for it happening. The Malkut Shemayni points out from the fact that the Pasuk says that they took, it says, the sons of Aaron, Nadav and Aviyu, took each one his fire pan. Those words indicate that they did what they did without consulting each other. That means each one took his fire pan. That means each one on their own decided to do this. For whatever reason they decided to do this, there was no discussion between the two of them. They each, on their own, took a fire pan, put in the fire, put in the incense, and went. I guess at one point they looked at each other and say, hey, you know, but originally what they were doing it on their own without consulting each other. And the Yalkut Shemayni is stressing this. It's stressing, the Paratara is stressing that when they did this, they did it independently. There was no discussion between the two of them about saying, hey, let's do this, it would be a great idea. Independently, each one did it on their own. What is the point of this Medrash? What is the Medrash trying to show us with this? And the Medrash is trying to show that actually, were they have to consult it with each other, perhaps they wouldn't have done it. Now you may ask, well, if they both had the same idea, you would think that if they'd bring up the idea to each other, they'd both agree, not disagree, right? Because if they're thinking the same way, then if they discuss it, then they'll come out with the same idea, right? But the Yalkut Shemayni is telling us, no. There is something that happens to us when we talk to someone about something. There's something that happens when we have an idea and we then have to kind of make it concrete in our minds, able to verbalize it to someone. It gives us greater clarity in what we're thinking. It's not necessarily going to be just because at the end we decided the same thing that, oh, if we would have talked about it, it would have been the same. But rather, when you have to go ahead and basically, you know, put together your thoughts, make them concise, make them clear, and express them to somebody else, that gives you greater clarity. And the Medrash is saying, if they would have consulted with each other, this wouldn't have happened. And of course, it's a lesson to us about how important it is that we, whatever it may be, and especially in learning, that we consult one another, that we learn with one another. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says that the Torah is acquired in 48 ways. And one of the ways is called Dikduk Chaverim. Dikduk Chaverim, which means friends being attentive to detail. Dikduk means, you know, being attentive in detail to what you're saying. And Rashi says, Dikduk Chaverim, what does that mean to be involved in your friends, having friends who are attentive to detail? Rashi says that means loymed b'chabura, means you learn with others. By learning with others, right, you will be attentive and detailed to each other, right? You're not just going to let each other get away with things. You're going to discuss things. You're going to get down to detail. And dikta chaver means you want to have a friend that's going to be attentive to detail and basically challenge you and help you understand. According to this understanding of what we just said, that just talking to someone, just speaking it out with someone, helps you in itself make get clarity in what you're saying, then the dikduk chaverim is not just the idea that when you gain from learning what someone else is, you get someone else's insight. Even if you don't get someone else's insight, the fact that you're now learning with someone else, and again, now you have to basically clarify to yourself what you're going to say and now express it to someone, that itself gives you clarity. There's another Mishnah in Pirkei Avos that says that asei lecha rav, make for yourself a rav, make for yourself a teacher. Which typically we think, many commentaries say that means you should have a teacher. Teacher means someone who you see knows more than you, has more experience than you. But the commentary of Rabbeinu Yoina actually says asei lecha rav means a chavrusa. Means a chavrusa. Study with someone else. Because you will gain more, because if that person now helps you in your understanding more of what you studied, he just became your rav. He just became your rebbe. So asei lecha rav doesn't just mean learn with a chavrusa, because as the Rabbeinu Yoina says, the chavrusa will help you understand better. Well, now, again, just another layer to that, the chavrusa may not be your rebbe in the sense that he's giving you new ideas, but again, by having a rav, by having the chavrusa, through him you're going to go ahead and you're going to gain more clarity in what you're saying, being that you again have to put your thoughts together to be able to verbalize them. That in itself has its effect, and that is what the Medrash is saying. The Torah is stressing here when it says each one took his own fire pan, that they independently decided and went in and did what they did, to imply that if they would have spoken to each other, this wouldn't have happened, because although it would seem that they were of the same mind, once you start having to express yourself to others, that just helps you gain more clarity in what you're doing. Okay. Now, let's read the next pasuk. Next pasuk reads, after they died, pasuk Gimel, Vayomer Moshe el Aaron. And Moshe said to Aaron, Hu asher diber Hashem limor, this is what Hashem said, Bekrovai Ekodesh, through those who are close to me I'll be sanctified, Vapre Chalom Ekoved, and on the face of the entire nation I will be honored. What does Rashi here mean? So, Rashi says on these words, Bekrovai, actually no, we're going to Rashi, right. Rashi, the first Rashi, Hu Asher Diber. This is what Hashem said when he said, Bikrovai Kadesh, through those who are close to me, I'll be sanctified. Heichan Diber, where did Hashem say this? The answer is, V'nai Adati Shemel Avdei Yisod Mekdash Bechvedi. Hashem says to Moshe, Shmeis Chavtes, I will meet there with the Jewish people, and I will be sanctified with my glory. Al Tikri Bechvedi, do not read it as Bechvedi, with my glory, El Mechubadai. But I will be sanctified through those who are honored by me. Omar loy Moshe l'Aaron. Moshe said to Aaron, Aaron achi, Aaron my brother. Yoridia ha'yisi sheyizkadeish habayis b'da'av shalmokim. I knew that the house, the Mishkan, would be sanctified through the beloved ones of Hashem. Meaning, when Hashem says, I will be sanctified with my honor, which we say doesn't mean with my honor, but with those who are honored by me. What does it mean, I will be sanctified through those who are honored by me? Moshe understood that meant to say, Hashem is going to say that the sanctity of the Mishkan will be established by someone desecrating it, being punished for it. And who is going to be the one punished for desecrating the sanctity? Not just some Joe Shmo, but Mechubadai. Those who are honored by me, somebody very beloved, somebody very honored to Hashem, somebody like that is going to do some kind of desecration to the Mishkan. That person, although he's so great, will be punished, and that will establish to everyone how holy and sanctified the Mishkan is. You can't mess with the sanctity of the Mishkan. So somebody honorable was going to be the one that was going to bring this about. And again, it was going to come about through some kind of a death. V'ayisi savra oibi oibach. Moshe says, I thought it was either going to be me or you. Ach shavroya ani shem godoyle mimeni umimeka. But now I see if they were the ones who it happened through, that they're greater than me and you. Now, this is interesting because it would seem to imply that the sin of Nadab and Avihu was not necessarily a sin unto itself that would necessarily carry a death punishment. However, at this point of time, where, again, it was the beginning of the establishment of the Mishkan, and those who would be doing it, for them would be considered a grave sin, and therefore for them punishable by death, that would bring about, again, to show the sanctity of the Mishkan. Now again, but it would seem that this kind of sin was a kind of sin for Nadab and Avihu because they were so great. This for them was the kind of sin that would bring it, that would bring about a punishment of death. And it was going to be specifically through great people. Great people, you know, somehow or another, desecrating the sanctity of the Mishkan, deserving of death for the fact that they did it. And that would establish the sanctity of the Mishkan. But those people who would be doing it would be the greatest. And because it's the greatest that are being punished for this, that would establish how holy and sanctified the Mishkan is. And Moshe understood, if Hashem says, Bichvaydi, B'mechubadai, my honored ones, it means the most honorable ones, the greatest ones. Therefore, Moshe says to Aaron, and he was saying this to comfort him, I see now that Nadab and Avihu are greater than us. Because if they were the ones that it came about through them, that the Mishkan sanctity was established, and Hashem is through to my honored ones, Moshe understood it means my most honored ones, and therefore I see, says Moshe, that they were greater than you and I. Now, the question is, really? Nadab and Avihu were greater than Moshe and Aaron? Moshe was the greatest prophet. Aaron was second, you know, second in command, so to speak, second in level. So Nadab and Avihu may have been very great men. I mean, the Gemara says that in their minds, they were probably right. They were next in line. And the Gemara says that one of their sins was the fact that they used to walk behind Moshe and Aaron and kind of say, like, you know, when's going to be our time? So you got to know what the Gemara means when it says that exactly. But they're expecting to be next in line, and it would seem that they were correct. So they were great people. But greater than Moshe and Aaron? What does it mean? So it's an explanation given by the Yisrael Yaakov Fisher Zatzal that there are really two types of tzaddikim, two types of gedolim, two types of great people. You've got people who are great because they perfect themselves, and then you have people who are great because they perfect others. And when you spend your time perfecting others, at the end of the day, it does take away from your ability to perfect yourself. Okay? At the same time, though, the Chavos Sababis writes that a person who is Mezakas HaRabim, a person who helps others, who brings merit to others, that person is in an overall higher spiritual level than the other person. Meaning, it's very possible that one person who has worked on himself and had the opportunity to work on himself will have a personal spiritual level that's higher than another person. But he's still not going to have as many merits, let's call it, as a person who has helped others, who has taught others, who has brought others to Torah and mitzvahs. And therefore, in the overall calculation, so to speak, in the overall reckoning, the person who may be personally and himself at a lower level is still on a higher level, so to speak, in the eyes of Hashem and merit-wise. So therefore, Moshe and Aaron looked at Nadab and Avihu, and Nadab and Avihu, they were unbelievable. Personally, the levels of spirituality and righteousness that they had reached were unbelievable. Even higher than them. Maybe in the sense of Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy that needs a little bit more explanation. But at the same time, you know, we never spoke about this year, but the Kli Yakar in Parashas Vayikra says that, and he says this based on the fact that the Baal HaTurim says that the word Vayikra has a small aleph. Why does it have a small aleph? Because Moshe wanted to write Vayiker instead of Vayikra, and he wanted to write Vayiker, which would mean that Hashem happened upon Moshe. The same wording that's used by Bilam. But Hashem wouldn't let him do that. But he got away with writing a small aleph. So the Kli Yakar explains that to mean that that what was Moshe Rabbeinu like? What was his point? What he was the same as Bilam? Of course, not the same as Bilam. But the point is that Bilam was not deserving of his level of prophecy that he attained. Every Navi has to become worthy of the level of prophecy that he attains. Bilam was not worthy of the level of prophecy that he attained, but he got it anyway. Moshe Rabbeinu, the level of prophecy that he had, that highest level of prophecy, essentially he wasn't worthy of. He did not bring himself personally to a level that he was deserving of that kind of prophecy. But in merit of Klal Yisrael, if there was anybody who was going to get, so to speak, an extra dose, it was going to be him. But therefore, when Moshe went to Vayikar, because Moshe is trying to say that my level of prophecy that I have is Vayikar. It's like Bilam. It's not real. It's something that Hashem gives me extra. But Hashem wouldn't let him do that, but so he got to make a little aleph. So again, Moshe Rabbeinu is the greatest prophet. But if again we say that Moshe Rabbeinu gained his prophet, the level that this high level prophecy he gained was actually a gift from Hashem, more than what he deserved, then it becomes a little easier to understand the fact that it's possible that Nadav and Avihu on a personal spiritual level were maybe higher than that Moshe and Aaron. But Moshe and Aaron, they were the leaders. They were the ones who had taught the Jewish people, led the Jewish people, taught them Torah, led them. Clearly, when it came to helping others, being mezakas aravim, teaching others, they were ahead of everybody in that. And therefore, Moshe thought that the mechubad, the honored ones of Hashem, would be Moshe and Aaron. Because, so to speak, in the overall level, in the overall calculation, they were the greatest. But now the other Naviyah were chosen, says Moshe, now I realize that, and perhaps before I didn't realize, but now I realize there was a aspect in which Nav and Naviyah were greater than Moshe and Aaron, and therefore they were the Mechubadai that Hashem was referring to. Because there was an aspect, at least at their personal spiritual level, Nav and Naviyah were greater. And those were the Mechubadai, those were the greatest that Hashem is referring to when he said, they will be the ones to sanctify my Mishkan. Moshe Rabbeinu thought it was them, because even Moshe Rabbeinu may have thought, even on a personal level, perhaps they're even greater than Nadav and Avihu. At the end, they realized Nadav and Avihu, at least in their personal level, were higher. And therefore, they were the Mechubadai. They were the ones Hashem is referring to when he said, my honored ones. But essentially, Moshe and Aaron are greater because they are the tzaddikim, the great ones, who are mezakas rabbim, teach Torah to others, and in overall calculation, that makes them greater.
You're saying that in the eyes of Hashem, they're greater. But personally, that's what people see. And that's the example we're looking for here, right? We want to show this an example of highest possible
I understand what you're saying. If I wanted to argue on that, maybe not everybody...
I think I'm supporting you.
No, I understand that. I'm just not sure if you could say it's, like, noticeable. Mm-hmm. You know? I'm not sure if that, like it was so noticeable to other people.
Personally, it's a dictum, yeah. That's what everybody thinks. Moshe, yeah, he's getting angry sometimes. You know.
Well, I didn't say that when... Yeah, but first of all... We didn't see... First of all, I don't know if we saw Moshe going to get angry yet.
Next question.
That's the next one. So far, not. But I'm saying I'm not going into that. I understand what you're trying to. I'm not going there. I'm going more in the fact that again, we're talking about two different levels. And again, I don't know if people in general would have noticed that. I don't know. It's an interesting point, you know. But at the same time, if it's made known that that the ones who are bring out the sanctity of the Mechubadai, the honored ones, right? The people realize that the Naviyah were those people.
But did they do something wrong?
Even if they did something wrong, it was something wrong that was wrong for them. What's your question? What are you asking?
Well, the question is, Aaron didn't do it, the two sons did something they shouldn't have done.
Right, so the point is that, but again, how would it happen? I understand what you're saying. You're saying, what would Moshe and Aaron have done that they should be the ones?
No, I'm saying if the two sons did something that they were killed for.
Right.
So that was something they should have known better.
That's true, but it doesn't mean it was something they were... But again, they were still establishing, as great as they were, that to have been punished, or they were punished for what they did, right, that had to do with their greatness and the sanctity of the Mishkan. But you're right, without doing something wrong, it wasn't going to happen. But at the same time, it, number one, doesn't mean that what they did was essentially deserving on its own for it. But it had to do with their level, who they were, and what we're dealing with. Okay. So that's the explanation. That could be the explanation of Rashi, what it means that they were greater than Moshe and Aaron. Now, after that it says, let's read the Pasuk Gimel again. Moshe said to Aaron, Hu asher dibar Hashem leimor, this is what Hashem spoke, said, the Krevaya Kadesh, through those who are close to me I will be sanctified, Valprei Chalem Ekaved, and in front of all the nation I will be honored. Vayidaim Aaron, and Aaron remained silent. Here it was, on a very special day, he lost his sons. Moshe Rabbeinu comforted him. Vayidaim Aaron, and Aaron was silent. Aaron was completely accepting of what had happened. And Rashi tells us that that as a reward for being silent, kibel schar al shtikasei, he received a reward for being quiet, for being silent. Umaschar kibel, what is that reward? Shedisachle v'adibor, that he got his own prophecy. Shemer l'levad v'parsh suyayin, he alone was given the part of the Torah that talks about the prohibition of a Kohen drinking wine before he goes into do the service. That's, if you turn to the next page, it says, Vayidaber Hashem al Aaron lemar. Hashem spoke to Aaron saying, Yain v'sheicher al teisht, wine don't drink. That law that was now given, that Hashem now said, that a Kohen cannot go do the avoid of the service if he drank a certain amount of wine, that was a prophecy to Aaron. That prophecy to Aaron was a reward. Typically, the prophecy wasn't a special prophecy for Aaron. It was typically a prophecy for Moshe. Then Moshe spread it. And here, there was something about this prophecy that was special to Aaron. Well, the reason why he got that was because here he was silent, and that was his reward. Now, I want to share with you an interesting little Chassidus Shemaisa that relates to this Vayidaim Aaron. And the story goes like this. When you used to be here, would I say Chassidus Shemaisis in those days? Okay. All right. So Vayidaim Aaron. So you tell your story like this. Reb Lipman, his name was Reb Lipman of Radomsk. He was a son-in-law of the Teferes Shloimei. Tiferes Shloimeh was known as the Radomsk Rebbe. And he came to Kutsk, and he went to the Kutsk Rebbe. When he came to the Kutsk Rebbe said to Reb Lipman, you know, can you share me a Torah thought from your father-in-law? So he said like this, that Chazal make a big fuss about Aaron's silence. This Vayidaim Aaron, Aaron remained silent over the death of his sons Nadab and Avihu. And Rashi says, because he was silent, he received a reward that there was a prophecy given special to him about the prohibition of wine. Okay, so clearly Aaron's silence was a very high level. It was he reached a very high level when he did that. But you know who reached a higher level than that? We find a higher level by David HaMelech. By David HaMelech, we find a higher level. David HaMelech says, we say this every morning in Mizmor Shir Chanukah Sabayis, L'man yizamer chachavod v'lo yidayim. So that the kavod, the honor, meaning the soul, shall sing to you, v'lo yidayim, and not be silent. So, Aaron was silent. David HaMelech says, I will sing and not be silent. Afilu be'etzmas atzar v'ke'ev, even in the midst of pain and suffering, what does David HaMelech say? L'may yizamer chachavod, I will sing to you, v'loyidam, and not be silent. So Aaron was praised for being silent. David HaMelech talks about not being silent, but rather singing. That even when he receives a terrible, he receives several terrible suffering from Hashem, he still thinks Hashem, he's going to sing Hashem's praises for it. That's the higher level. And Aaron didn't do that. And the Kotzker, it says, he liked it. He was impressed by it. He liked it. Okay, so it's an interesting idea. Like, Does it mean David HaMelech reached a higher level? Did he speak about a higher level? But according to this story, okay, the Aaron clearly did a great thing, that he was silent, that he accepted. The higher level would have been that to actually not be silent, but rather sing praises to Hashem, and to praise Hashem for it. To be on such a level that you understand Hashem's, that whatever Hashem does is for my good, to the point that for even such a thing, you don't just remain silent and accept, you sing. You sing to Hashem, sing to Hashem praises for it. So I heard a thought from I think his name is Rabbi Nelson Greenberg, and he wanted to, you know, with all due respect to the Radomska, he wanted to say an explanation for Aaron's silence that maybe brings out the idea that Aaron's silence is even still greater than David HaMelech's idea, the David HaMelech statement. And I'd like to elaborate on what he said with a piece from the Chavis HaLavis. The Chavis HaLavis has a section called Shar HaBitachon, the gate of trust in Hashem. And at the end of that gate, he says that he talks about the different levels of trust that a human being goes through. He starts off with the fact that a baby puts its trust in its mother's breasts because that's his recognition of what his survival comes from. When he gets older, he recognizes his mother. As he gets older, he recognizes that his mother is dependent on his father. So his trust goes to his father. There's a point where the person starts realizing he can take care of himself, puts his trust in himself. If he realizes that his livelihood and his survival is dependent on someone else, he puts trust in someone else.
The boss.
If his cognizance of Hashem becomes greater, well, then at least, you know, when it comes to things that he has no control over, others have the control over, like rain or tornadoes or earthquakes, you know, those are the kinds of things that he puts trust in Hashem, things that are beyond anybody's control. At a higher level of trust, he comes to a point where, okay, even things that he has influence in, but it's like the kinds of things that, you know, yeah, I can become a seafarer, but in the times of the Gemara, that was an extremely dangerous source of livelihood. Yeah, I could travel deserts and be a merchant from country to country, but going through deserts is very dangerous. So although I can do it, but those are the kinds of things that, again, at a higher level of, there's a level of betachon that a person brings himself to, like, all right, I'm not doing this. I'm going to do something else and put my trust in Hashem that this other thing will work. And then there is a level of betachen, maybe I'm skipping one, a level of betachen where whether the means of livelihood and survival are easy or hard, he puts his trust in Hashem and he knows everything's in everything comes from Hashem, and everything that he does, even in making a livelihood, is in the service of Hashem. Now, there is a point like this. When a person's recognition grows, when a person's cognizance grows in the mercy that Hashem has for his creations, meaning a person comes to a certain point of recognition and cognizance about that everything that Hashem does is for our best. You know, we try to say that, we try to think it, we try to believe it, but there's a level in which you really hit it. Right? You really hit that level that you really recognize, and it's really part of you that whatever Hashem does is for my good. When you hit that level, you hit a level of Yirtzeh B'Mashiyah Migzeres Elokim Eloi. You want whatever Hashem decrees for you, B'Libayu B'Lashonai. The person now wants that in his heart, on his tongue, B'Nireya B'Nistarai, on the outside, on the inside. And he rejoices in everything Hashem does for him, from death to life, poverty to riches, health and sickness. He doesn't desire anything other than what Hashem chooses. He only wants what Hashem wants. V'nimsa alekim, he gives himself over completely to Hashem, Umashlech nafshe begufay al dinah, he surrenders his soul and body to Hashem's decree, judgment. Vloyagre inyan al inyan, and he never says one way is better than the other. Vloyivchar zulas mashehu bayi meinyanei ilamai, and he doesn't choose any other thing or want any other thing in his situation in this world than what Hashem wants. K'may sh'amar echem min abaitchem, as the Chavis HaLava says, one of the true people that trust in Hashem said, Vayishkamti me'olam be'inyin, I never woke up in the morning in a certain state, v'savis elezulasai, I desired a different one. I never woke up in the morning saying, oy, I wish. No, he never woke up that way. Whatever Hashem wanted, that's perfectly fine with me. Perfectly fine. So here you have a person, right, who basically comes to the level where it's not like it's tough, it's hard, but I accept and I work on it and I work on accepting and I work on moving forward and I try not to be angry. This is the person who says whatever he wants is perfectly fine. Perfectly fine. Perfectly fine. Whatever he wants is what I want. Because I know whatever he's doing is for the good. So could we say that such a person who is like that is maybe on the higher level of the person who sings the praise to Hashem for it? What's he singing a praise to Hashem for? He could be saying praise to Hashem because, but again, this specific thing, right? If he's singing praise to Hashem, it means that this specific thing was something different, but I know it's for my best, so thank you, Hashem. But there's a certain recognition that it's kind of, in some level, not the way it should be, or not the way I want it to be. But the person who's like this, yeah, I mean, I clearly Aaron wants his children, right? But if this is what Hashem says, he's not looking for anything else. He's not looking for anything else. So maybe the Vayidam Aaron's silence is actually this level. It's not just being quiet. It's actually a level that says, this is what Hashem wants, this is what I want. It's fine.
Praying Hashem is sort of obligation.
But that's a general obligation. It's not an obligation for this specific thing, it's for anything. So he's going to, so sure, every day Aaron wakes up in the morning and he davens and he sings the praises of Hashem. The Radomsker's idea was, I'm appraising you for this thing, right? No, Aaron was quiet, but nobody else not quiet. But it's focusing on this specific thing. Aaron doesn't look at this different than anything else. Because whatever Hashem wants is what he wants. He doesn't wake up in the morning and saying, oh, you know, I mean, this is a tremendous level. We're not talking about a level that simple people can attain. And by the way, the Chavos HaLevavos has another level higher than this, which he says is the level, which is really a level of just complete attachment to Hashem. Complete attachment to Hashem. You love Hashem so much that nothing else matters in the world. So we're talking about high level, and he says that's the level of the Nevi'im. So we're talking about high levels here. So this level is a level below what's unique to a Navi. So the Navi already has this level. So to say that Aaron had this level of complete submission in the sense of whatever Hashem wants, that's what I want. I don't desire anything else. That may be actually higher than David HaMelech Sleman Yizamercha, or at least the way the Radomsker explained it.
So does this man ever pray?
Who?
This man who is always satisfied. Does he ever pray?
Sure.
What does he ask Hashem for if he is?
Because you always have to ask Hashem for everything. Whatever Hashem, you always have to ask Hashem. You always have to look to Hashem and say, "I need you," well, and everything comes from you.
Sort of my point, but if then he just saying it because he does.
No, because he's thanking Hashem for everything. He knows what he gets. He knows what he gets, and he knows he has to recognize that he gets it from Hashem. He knows that he needs it from Hashem. He doesn't get it on his own.
But he never asks for anything.
Maybe he does ask. Because Hashem always wants us to ask.
Well, that's
because at the end of the day, you know what your needs are. But at the other hand, if the Rebbe Shlomo, it becomes clear, Rebbe Shlomo says no. becomes clear. Hashem says no. Right. Hashem answers no.
Yeah.
Right. What's the reaction then?
Yeah, but he needs to be on the level to actually understand what Hashem wants.
He has to be on the level. No, he has to be on the level that he that the idea that everything that Hashem does is for the good is so clear to him. That even without that, even without exactly knowing what it is.
You can ask for something that you think is the right thing, then you get back something else, and the answer at that level is, interesting, why is it the right thing?
Well,
I was wrong.
I was trying to construct situations where, so you have a goal and it didn't work out.
Right.
The question is, what do you do next? You could say, well, Hashem doesn't want it. Or you try it the second time.
Good. So you can still try it a second time because it's very interesting. You know, I'll try to apply this. There's an interesting medrash that says that when Avram Avinu was going to the Akedah, the whole time he was davening for Hashem to change his mind.
Right.
Something like that. We spoke about this once.
Right. Yeah.
So that means a person is allowed to look at his situation, right? And understand and say that you know, there is a way a situation should be, or a way a situation I want, right? And I can ask Hashem for it. Question is, what do you do afterwards? How are you able to deal with it afterwards? But Hashem always wants us. Hashem does not want you to sit back and say, "Okay, Hashem, whatever you want, I'll take," because then you become complacent. Okay. All right, next. Later on in the parasha talks about the kosher animals and non-kosher animals. So let's turn to page 600, where we have a list, where the Torah lists the non-kosher birds. If you take a look at Pasuk Yud Tes, this is page 600, Perikud Aleph, Pasuk Yutes. And the bird mentioned here is Ve'ez HaChasida. The Chasida bird is not kosher. So some say a Chasida, I think they translate it as an ostrich or a pelican. I don't know, one of these kind of birds. Okay. But whatever it is, right? At the end of the day, the only birds that we eat are the ones that we have a tradition are the kosher birds. The Torah says what's not kosher, which means everything else is kosher. But we don't really know what all these birds are. So we have to work with a tradition of what are the kosher birds. But one of these non-kosher birds is called a chasida, right? Chasida, right? Sounds like a very pious bird, right? Chasida. Okay. So Rashi says that the chasida, this bird, you know why it's called chasida? So Rashi says, "Lamidik Roshma Chasida." Why is it called Chasida? She'ais haChasidus im Chavrei Seha b'Mezaynus. It does piety. It does kindness for its friends when it comes to food. It shares its food. Right? All those other birds you watch, right? When you throw bread, they're all killing each other for it. No sharing there, right? This bird shares its food. So it's called a Chasida. It's kind. Chesed. It's kind. It's pious. So, the famous question is, if it's such a nice bird, why isn't it kosher? So the famous answer is, because as Rashi says, Shoysa chasidus im chavarei seha b'mezaynus, it does kindness with its friends in food. It only shares food with its friends. If it's not your, if you're not the chasidus friend, it's not going to share with you. Okay? So the point would be that this bird, it's worse than, the other birds aren't even nice. All right. But if you're only nice to your friends, right, then that's not a proper sign. And because of that not proper sign, that's why we could possibly suggest a possible reason as to why this bird is not kosher. It seemingly has a good trait, that's why it's called chasida, but in essence, in that good trait, there's something very lacking, and therefore, don't wonder why, even though it seems to have a good nature, it's still not a kosher bird.
So it seems like we prefer the ones who don't share with anyone.
Well, they're not kosher, what do you mean?
No,
you mean the other birds? The other birds.
The ones that do it.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's better. Like, you know, there's something about the idea. Like, I'm only friendly with I only share with others. You know, with others. But let's see. Maybe we can get an answer to that. Now, the thing is like this. So it seems like the problem again. Now this is a Hamilelka interpretation, but it's a famous one. But whatever. But it would seem to imply to us though that you know, there's something wrong with this bird taking care of its own and not going outside of its circle. So, you know, it's worth mentioning, you know, we do know that when it comes to tzedakah,
yeah,
there's a priority list.
Exactly.
Right? Right? Right. It says, what's the word? What's the phrase? What's the phrase? Something with craven. Whatever. Your relatives come first. Your family comes first.
It's not necessarily friends.
Right.
It's not the same thing.
Right. Begins. Your neighbors.
Yeah.
There's a whole priority list, right? There's clearly a priority list, right? You know? And therefore, and yes, probably your friend, if the person is your, I have to look in Shulchan Aruch to see for sure, right? But there's clearly a priority to your neighbor, priority to somebody who lives in your city than someone else in a different city, right? There is something about the idea of a priority list,
yeah.
And that being and giving to those who are closer to you.
It's not the same as Henry.
Why?
Would be other gang members.
What?
Other members of my gang.
What do you mean
it's
by that?
It's not necessarily my relatives. These are self-selected people. That's what Henry meant, right?
What?
Chavirim is not the same as your
yeah, but
family.
But Chavirim, but I'm saying that there's it's very possible to say there's a bigger responsibility to your friends than people who aren't your friends.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like we say, B'nai Yerecha, the people in your city come before people in another city. So and the and also interestingly, the Chavetz Chaim says that this priority list isn't just for tzedakah, it's even for any chesed. Okay? And therefore, what exactly, you know, when we do talk about that, you know, those who are closer to you are those who get first, you know. So what's that different than what this chassid is doing? So the answer is pretty basic. And that is, number one, the first thing is that if you had, first of all, even when you have to go ahead and give to, let's say, your relatives or your neighbors first, right? What if the person on your priority list, right, has bread, but they don't have meat, right? And somewhere lower on the list doesn't even have bread. Who goes first? The halacha is not your brother who needs a piece of meat, but the person who's further away who doesn't even have bread. If the needs are identical, then we say, okay, priority goes to the closer one, to the closer relative, the closer person to you. But if that's not identical, if they're not identical, then you go out of the priority list, right? So the chasida is stuck to its friends, right? I do my friends. I don't go beyond that. So first of all, although we know there is a priority to friends, but it doesn't mean you don't go beyond it. First of all, you're going to go beyond it because of the fact that there may be a situation where you actually are supposed to go to somebody further first because they have a greater need. That's number one. Number two, a more basic difference is which I thought you were saying before, and that is that again the chasida only does its friends, right? Only does its friends. It won't go beyond its friends, right? If I can't go beyond my relatives or friends, it's not because I don't feel that I should, or that I feel I don't need to, or that these people aren't worthy of my help. I just have a greater responsibility to them. When the needs are the same, and there's a priority list that says you got to go in and give to your family first, or to your closer friends first, or those close to you first, that responsibility is a responsibility that said that the idea behind that is I have a greater responsibility to those closer to me. I'm not exempt from people who aren't closer to me. I have a greater responsibility to those who are closer to me. And therefore, they come first. Right? But if I have enough for everybody, of course, I got to give to everybody. The chassida basically is selfish. The chassida takes care of itself. its friends are an extension of itself. And therefore, it'll help the friends. But beyond that, it won't go. So really, essentially, it expresses a very selfish attitude. The attitude of taking care of your own first is not necessarily selfish if you look at it as, I have a greater responsibility, I have a responsibility to them first. But not that they're the only ones worthy of my help. So therefore, you've got the chassid that is very specific to what's going to help. That's not the Jewish attitude. We're not specific to who we help. We may have priorities to who we help. We have responsibilities first to those to help. We may have responsibility to others before others, but not to the exclusion of others. So that's a very basic idea. It's a simple answer, but it's worthwhile to speak out because, again, you talk about chassid to its friends. Well, you know, we have priorities too. Okay, but it only sticks to its friends. Our priorities don't say only stick to your friends. It means you have a greater responsibility to them.
The same action would be judged differently depending on motivation.
Right, right. You know, it's an interesting... While I was preparing this, I remembered an interesting story that I read in Mishpacha magazine from Rabbi Eisenman of Passaic. And he tells a story. Again, this is like the idea of kind of when things go out of order. So the story goes that there was someone, you know, I guess involved in a shul, who during a hurricane, I guess it was Hurricane Sandy or one of the big hurricanes, I think maybe it was when they had those Houston tornado or the flood, whatever it was, and people were sending packages to Houston. So there was one person who was very involved in doing chesed, and he was busy organizing trucks and all these different things to deliver food to people who really needed. And his wife needed him also. He wasn't home because he was busy taking care of everybody else. And she expressed her frustration to Rabbi Eisenman. So Rabbi Eisenman got into the car. He pulled up to the area where her husband was working, or busy with making sure everything gets on the trucks. And he goes, Chaim, I need you. Somebody needs you desperately. He says, but Rabbi, I'm trying to take it. You got to come. I need you. I need you. I need you to help somebody. I need you. He says, okay. He gets into the car, drives him up, and drops him off by the house. And he says, right there. That's where you need it. Now, the point there is that there you have a situation where the person was going to others before those who needed him closer. Because the idea, again, is, we, in essence, we should all want to be like that person. We should all want to help whoever we can. But we have to understand we have a responsibility to those who are closer to us. But in essence, when we can only help out, when we can only fulfill our responsibilities, we should feel bad that we can't go beyond that. That's not the chassidah. This is where I go, and that's it. You can have so many people that are stingy and don't share and don't give, but to their families, the best, because it's an extension of themselves. Well, okay.
There's a slight problem with this. Is that chassidah is really that bad? Why would we go over that?
Because we actually want to bring out this trait. We want to bring out the trait. When we're at the trait. And perhaps to answer your question before, about why, what about the other animals who don't share that are kosher? Right? Maybe the answer is that if you're already being nice, right, you fail more when you don't go further. Perhaps. Perhaps. Okay. Last thing I want to share with you is the following. This is one of the last psukim in the parasha, page 606. Very last pasuk, Perek Yud Aleph, pasuk Mem Zayin. Lahavdil ben Atame ben Atahar, to distinguish between the impure and the pure. Between the animal that can be eaten, between the animal that cannot be eaten. So Rashi comments here, what does it mean to distinguish between the pure and impure, which would mean the kosher, impure. It's not talking about pure, impure species, kosher species, not kosher species. That was discussed before. But rather, it means, what are we referring to distinguish between that which is pure to you and that which is impure to you? The point is, the impure means where the pipes that have to be slaughtered for an animal were only cut through halfway, or they were cut through the majority. Meaning, shechita is done when the animal is cut by the windpipe and the trachea. Is that the same thing? Esophagus and the trachea. Whatever they're called. But the two pipes, the air pipe and the food pipe, right? The knife goes and cuts. Now, you know, when you cut, you're going to cut, you know, the whole way. But it's possible, halachically, not to cut through the entire pipe. But it's still a kosher shechita if you cut through the majority. If you only did halfway, treif, nevela. A little more, just a little more.
51%.
51% makes it kosher. So to distinguish between kosher and not kosher, an animal kosher slaughtered properly, that's kosher. An animal not slaughtered properly, that's not kosher, is that could be a hairline of a difference. Hairline of a difference. Okay, that's the lahavdil. Okay, so I want to share with you, maybe you remember this from a long time ago, but I want to share with you an email that somebody shared with me once that brings out the idea. I mean, so the idea, there's an idea that's brought out here is that, you know, when it comes to Torah law, a little difference could have such huge ramifications, right? A little more cutting, a little less cutting, a little more cutting makes all the difference in the world, right? Huge halachic ramifications depend on even small differences, small little things. So I have this email. This email must have been like an email that's sent to like an Ask the Rabbi email list. So question of the week. Why does the Jewish religion seem to obsess over insignificant details? How much matzah do we have to eat? Which spoon do I use for milk and which for meat? Which is the right way to tie my shoelaces? It seems to me that this misses the bigger picture by focusing on minutia. Is this nitpicking what Jews call spirituality? That's the question. You know, half, a little bit higher than that, little, only half, more than half, right? That's, you know, nitpicking, minutia. Answer. Okay, well, actually, here I flipped something. In parentheses, the questioner writes, I actually already sent you this question over a week ago and didn't receive a reply. Could it be? Do you get the story ready?
Could it, too busy doing
this? No. Could it be that you have finally been asked a question that you can't answer?
Okay. This reminds me of my students.
Answer. I never claim to have all the answers. There are many questions that are beyond me. But it happens to be that I did answer your question, and you did get the answer. I sent the reply immediately. The fact that you didn't receive it is itself the answer to your question. You see, I sent you a reply, but I wrote your email address leaving out the dot before the com. I figure that you should still receive the email because, after all, it's only one little dot missing. I mean, come on. It's not as if I wrote this wrong name or something drastic like that. Would anyone be so nitpicky as to differentiate between Yahoo.com and Yahoo.com? You see how well this email is. Isn't it a bit ridiculous that you didn't get my email just because of a little dot? No, it's not ridiculous. Because the dot is not just a dot. It represents something. The dot has meaning far beyond the pixels on the screen that form it. To me, it may seem insignificant, but that is simply due to my ignorance of the ways of the web. All I know is that with the dot, the message gets to the right destination. Without it, the message is lost to oblivion. Jewish practices have infinite depth. Each nuance and detail contains a world of symbolism. And every dot counts. When they are performed with precision, a spiritual vibration is emailed throughout the universe, all the way to God's inbox. That's Lahavdil, right? That's to differentiate between halfway and a little bit more than halfway. That little bit difference, Like, what's the difference? I mean, the thing bleeds to death anyway. All the blood comes out anyway. What's the difference? You may not know the difference. You may not see the difference. But there is a difference. And it's not just a random difference. It's a difference that in Hashem's, in the world that Hashem has created, in all the worlds that He has, it makes a big difference. You don't see it. We don't see it. But it makes a huge difference. And that's the Lahavdil, distinguished just between halfway cut and majority cut. Right, thank you all for coming.
There is one pragmatic explanation of that approach. I think the Moshe Mondo